Hello and welcome to the Club Lifestyle Podcast. My name is David Greenwalt. If you are a parent or have an influential role in a child's life, you will not want to miss a second of the interview I did with childhood eating and feeding expert Ellen Satter. Are you ready to hear about her? Well, hang on. This woman has an amazing background, so this is kind of long. Ellen Satter is an internationally recognized authority on eating and feeding, a family therapist and feeding and eating specialist. Satter has a private psychotherapy practice in Madison, Wisconsin. Her books, journal, and magazine articles, teaching materials, seminars, and media interviews have made her well known to the lay public, professionals, and the media as the leading authority on nutrition and feeding of infants and children of all ages. Satter's stated mission is to revolutionize feeding and eating. Her unconventional advice? Do what comes naturally. As long as adults do their jobs with feeding, children do a good job with eating. They intuitively eat the right amount of food to grow well. They naturally push themselves along to learn to like new foods. We did too at one time. We did, that is, until it was educated out of us by well-meaning adults and misguided, puritanical rules about eating. Satter knows whereof she speaks, given her 40 years experience helping people of all ages with their eating and with feeding their children. Satter's clear and vivid explanations of normal and distorted eating and feeding have made her a popular interviewee and speaker. The author of Division of Responsibility in Feeding, Parents Are Responsible for What, When, and Where of Feeding, Children Are Responsible for the How Much and Whether of Eating, Satter has led nutrition, health, and mental health professionals as well as the general public to adopt wise and emotionally healthy approaches to feeding and eating. Satter's books are valued by both professional and lay readers as authoritative, practical, humorous, and entertaining. Your Child's Weight, Helping Without Harming, recommends solving the problem of children overweight throughout the growing up years by doing the opposite of what seems right. In other words, feeding children rather than restricting them. Child of Mine, Feeding with Love and Good Sense, helps parents observe and understand their children and translate that insight into good feeding. Secrets of Feeding a Healthy Family teaches fast, efficient, delicious, and nutritious food management for the thinking cook. And lastly, How to Get Your Kid to Eat But Not Too Much details feeding and solving feeding problems, birth through adolescence. I have to tell you, reading Ellen's book, Your Child's Overweight, Helping Without Harming, was really a great learning experience for me and provided a shift in how I think about childhood obesity and how I'll be helping my clients from here forward. Just as a child would when they are forced to eat their broccoli, don't turn your nose up at Ellen's concepts until you've done two things. One, listen to both parts of this podcast, since it's in two parts, and two, read Ellen's book discussed in the interview. Only then can you really say you are informed about what may be best for your child. Keep an open mind and get ready to change some ways you look at overweight children and the whole family dynamics of eating. And now, I leave you with part one of my interview with Ellen Satter. Okay, welcome everyone. This is David Greenwald, and today I have a very special guest on. Her name is Ellen Satter. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, David.
Ellen, would you tell us about yourself? What's your education and professional training?
Well, I've been at this for 40 years. I started out back in 1963 as a registered dietitian with a master's degree working in an outpatient medical practice, wherein I learned that all my highfalutin ideas that I learned in school about getting people to eat in certain ways and getting them thin just were not going to work. And also, moreover, learned that when I taught parents how to restrict their children to get them thin, that it was awful. It did not work one bit at all. It turned the children into preoccupied food sneaks, and it turned the parents or the siblings into spying tattletales and the parents into police officers.
Is that all?
Yep, that was all. It absolutely wrecked the families. And so I went back to graduate school about 25 years ago and got a master's degree in clinical social work, whereupon I started to practice as a mental health profession and try to figure out what to do to be more helpful to people and not drive them so crazy. And in the last, you know, it took me about 5-10 years to do it, but I finally figured it out, and I've been testing my method, and finally I wrote about it.
Okay, awesome. Well, how about your personal life yourself? Because some people want to say, well, she's going to teach us about this, but, you know, does she actually have any kids? Does she have any family? What's the deal?
Yeah, I raised 3 kids.
Okay.
My youngest is, I think he's pushing 35. He was born in 1971, so that's about right. And my children are all just average weight.
Right.
My 2 boys were pretty chubby when they were little, especially the third one was above the 97th percentile. And if you read your child's weight, you know what that is. It means he was a pretty big kid.
Right.
And he loved to eat. But I didn't worry about him because I assumed that nature knew what it was doing with him. I did an excellent job of feeding him, and thank my lucky stars I didn't have to restrict him because it would have spoiled our relationship. And over the first 12 years, he ever so gradually slimmed down, and by the time he was 12 or 15 years old, he was this really lean kid, and he's been lean ever since. And, you know, this is the case with all my children. And my kids have the genes for fatness, you know, that I've got obesity on both sides of the family. But nonetheless, you know, they have, their weights have been very stable and consistent, and they haven't had to worry about it.
Well, the book I'm specifically going to be asking you about today is Your Child's Weight, Helping Without Harming, Birth Through Adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the book I'm familiar with, and that's what really got me excited about speaking with you, because as I told you just before we did the interview, it was really it was a change in my own thinking after reading your book about how to address this. And one of the things I want to ask you right off the bat is, should we say you're a childhood obesity expert, or how do you like to be referred as?
I keep shifting that around, but right now I think the most descriptive topic or the most descriptive title of me is eating and feeding therapist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly an eating and feeding expert, mm-hmm. and I am a child overweight expert. All of that applies, but I think that the title of therapist addresses the fact that I look at problems in detail. I don't, and before I make any recommendations about sort of established problems, I want to know what there is to know about the child's history, about the way parents handled feeding from the time he was little, what his growth was like, what's going on right now in the family. And so I can get a pretty clear fix on what's causing problems, if there is a problem, and what to do to fix them. And so that, you know, means that I'm really more of a therapist in the way I work with people clinically than I am, you know, an advisor or, you know, a nutritionist or a dietitian.
Why the interest in this side of things? As an RD and moving into other things, you could have done 100 different things. Why this?
Because my patients came back to see me. I was working in this medical clinic, as I told you a while ago, mm-hmm. and one of the very great privileges I had in that setting was I was able to do follow-up. So I would teach people these nifty diets that I had coming out of school, and they'd come back in, and they just were singularly unsuccessful. And not only that, but they were miserably unhappy. You know, following my diets kind of took all the pleasure out of eating for them. And, you know, the longer I did this and the more people came back in, I began to realize that this, you know, what I was doing for and with my patients was really pretty destructive, and that together we were getting into this serious dilemma, because certainly people had medical conditions that needed to be addressed, and presumably following a diet would do that, but people just weren't able to follow the diet. And so it became a wonderful mystery that I just was so interested in solving. that, plus the fact that I love to integrate, you know, that I am a real integrative thinker, and I like to take, you know, concepts and theories and principles from one field and put them together with another field and come out with a whole where the whole makes sense and is helpful to people. And I think that, I'm really pleased with your child's weight because I think that's a real good example of integrative thinking and principles, you know, child development, family interaction, physiology, nutrition, it's all in there.
I absolutely agree, and people will see by the end of this interview why, but I'm just going to say it now that, it, you know, any parent or any person who has a an influential relationship with a child and is concerned about the child's weight or concerned about feeding a child properly would be insane not to have your child's weight helping without harming. And that's coming from someone who coaches and teaches nutrition and fitness and body transformation on a daily basis. I learned a lot from it, so I know other people are too. But what I want to ask you then is, you tell parents that their child being thin is not the most important thing. Now, that seems pretty obvious to me, that being thin isn't the most important thing, but you've got it in the book, so why would you need to say that in the book?
Because parents are getting so much pressure now, and so many alarming messages about, you know, oh, today's children are getting fatter and fatter, and we just have to do about something about it, and child overweight is this horrible health problem, and parents who don't do something about it are downright neglectful and remiss in doing their job. And, you know, those messages like that are so alarmist that, any responsible parent would be spooked by them and feel, maybe I should be doing something about this, forgetting that really the bottom line is loving and accepting their child the way they are and doing an excellent job of parenting and letting the child's weight turn out in a way that is right for him or her.
Can you tell us what you mean by Ellen Satter's division of responsibility in feeding? That's said throughout the book. Trust me, by the time you get to page 50, you will have seen that at least 25 times.
Yeah, and you're saying, oh, yeah, you know, I don't want to hear this again. I don't read it again.
No, it's a real great way to reinforce it. So what does that mean?
Well, I'll tell you first, and then I want you to ask me why it has to have my name on it.
Okay.
The feeding demands a division of responsibility. The parent is responsible for the what, when, and where of feeding, and the child is responsible for the how much and the whether of eating. That means the parent is the one who gets to choose the food that comes into the house, gets to plan the meals, maintains the structure of meals and snacks, decides ahead of time when the meals are going to be, when the snacks are going to be, and I'm talking about sit-down snacks, not running around the house eating all the time snacks or munching in front of the TV snacks. Sit down, you eat it, you get it over with. And the parent is the one who makes mealtime pleasant by eating with the child, not just feeding the child, and sort of managing the sociability at the table so, you know, it's a pleasant place to be and that everybody looks forward to getting together there. And then once the parent has done all those jobs, then they have to let go of it. And they have to turn it over to the child to decide what and how much to eat of the food that the parent has put before them. And the parent also has turned over to the child to grow in the way that nature intended him or her to grow. And that's maybe the hardest part of all, is that whole part where we have to stow our agendas about how the body, child's body turns out, and, you know, and sort of backing away from that, stow our agenda about getting our kids to eat their vegetables or drink their milk or, you know, all of these things that once the parent puts the food on the table, that's, they're doing all they can, and they're doing a great deal.
So now I'm going to bring you back to the whole Bob Dole third person thing, where they used to say that the presidential candidate, Senator Bob Dole, used to speak in third person. You know, Bob Dole doesn't eat vegetables or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So it becomes, what's the deal with Ellen Satter's division of responsibility to feeding?
Well, you know, I stated the division of responsibility about over 20 years ago in my first book, Child of Mine, and also in a professional article, a journal article I wrote at the time. Well, people loved it, and they started to quote it, and they started to put it in articles and so on. But now, with all this hysteria about child overweight, people are using it, and then they're spoiling it. They're saying division of responsibility in feeding and control portion size, division of responsibility and kids need to eat fruits and vegetables, division of responsibility and restrict fat. And so essentially, they want to have it both ways. You know, they want to sort of recite this division of responsibility idea, but then they still want to be controlling. You know, they're just not willing to do the part that I emphasize so strongly, which is letting go of it once the parent has done their jobs. And so essentially what they're doing is wrecking the division of responsibility and taking away all of its power. And so, you know, if you have a parent, in fact, I just talked on the telephone to a parent who said, I've been doing division of responsibility for 3 months and my child is just still eating bread and butter. And I said, well, do you think you're doing anything that's kind of, you know, putting pressure on her? Because if your intent is to get her to eat certain amounts and types of food, your child is going to know it. And she'll do the opposite. She said her child really would, because she was a very spirited child. And, oh, yeah, and the more she thought about it, the more she realized that she was doing things like, you know, being all enthusiastic about this wonderful food, naming the food. The mother would eat the food and she'd say, this is really good. and of course, this little girl who was 5 years old, I mean, she was on to her. And she was experiencing all this shenanigans of the mother as being pressure. And, of course, if you put pressure on kids to eat anything, they're not going to eat it. You know, maybe they're scared, maybe they're get stubborn, maybe they have to lose face to do it, but they're just, you know, it makes them not eat it. And so she had to catch herself in all these ways that she was putting pressure on her daughter and stop it.
Yeah, that's if there's anything that I, you know, really picked up out of the book that would be one of the most important things, it's parents that try to be cute and clever are going to lose.
Right.
And not wait. They're going to lose in other ways.
Well, right. Are you sure you really want that?
Yeah.
And then there's the look.
Right.
You know, that hairy eyeball.
You bet. Well, you say that family meals are a key to providing and to parenting. And I think this is probably, to be honest, from what I got, it's probably the single most important point you drove home the book.
Yeah.
Now, can you explain what a family meal is and why it's important? What do you mean by family meal?
Well, you know, I've thought about that and written about it even more since I wrote Your Child's Weight. And what I mean by a family meal is when one or both of the parents are there, and, you know, it's sure like to have both of them. Everybody sits down together. Everybody eats the same food, or at least they're offered the same food. They don't have to eat it. And that you have time for this pleasant, sociable time where people are just paying attention to each other and setting aside the time to be together.
And that's it?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Why is it wrong to be casual about meals? Let me just ask a couple of points here, and you can just kind of string the answer together.
It scares kids. It
scares kids to be casual.
Right.
And by casual, you mean what?
Well, that parents, you know, sort of off again, on again about feeding. They might or might not have a meal, depending on how busy they are. They might not keep track of the time. And so the child has to say, I'm hungry. And then the parent gets around to eating. And so, you know, children are such a captive audience with their eating, you know, that we're the ones in charge of the food supply, that if parents don't make it clear that there's structure here and the parent's really paying attention to it, they implant, well, you said it, fear. I mean, the kid just feels this fear. But so the parent then that has to pay attention to this structure. You want to hear another feeding story?
Yeah, you bet.
Little boy, 5 to 7 years old, was throwing up all the time. Every single time he ate, the kid just absolutely gorged himself and And then he threw up. He couldn't hold it. And so parents took him to the gastroenterologist, and this doctor was really on top of things rather than, you know, doing that thing that seems logical, which is to say, don't let him eat so much. The doctor started to ask a few questions, and come to find out that these parents were both really busy, and this kid was a little tail ender. And so they'd kind of gotten out of the business of parenting.
Mm.
And as a result, they were just, sometimes they'd have a meal and sometimes they wouldn't. You know, they were just really casual about it. And this little kid was apparently frightened by that. And so he ate when the eating was good. He'd eat as much as he could hold whenever there was a meal. So the doctor said, well, that's it, all right. Have three meals and three snacks. And so the parents did. They stepped right up to the plate. They went home. They made their meals. They were absolutely religious about their structure. And within a week, the child had stopped throwing up.
Man, that's a great testament. It's amazing that, I mean, the child actually threw up because why? He was nervous?
He just was eating so much. He was so afraid of going hungry.
Oh, he overate when he ate.
That he would just stuff himself. He would eat as much as he could possibly hold.
Wow.
And then he'd, you know, sort of tip his stomach over the top, and then he'd lose it all.
Man, that's amazing.
Yeah, isn't it?
Well, tell us about grazing, short order cooking, and then always, you know, just kind of just ask your child what they want to eat. What's wrong with all those things? Grazing, short order cooking, just ask the child whatever they want.
Well, so let's start with the principle of the family meal.
Okay.
Right? Now, for meals have to be reinforcing for parents as well as children, so that means that they put on food that they enjoy, first of all. But it also means that it's reinforcing for them when the child arrives at the table hungry and is interested in the food there and willing to experiment with it. If you allow a child to graze all the time, that is panhandle constantly for food, mm-hmm. snack, eat on the run, the child is just plain not going to be hungry when he gets to the table. In fact, way back in my clinical dietitian days, I found that one of the biggest deterrents to a child's eating well at meals, and even a deterrent to family meals, was allowing the child to carry around apple juice. It was always apple juice.
That's common.
Kids would come in, and they'd be drinking 16, 20, 30 ounces of apple juice a day, and then, of course, they weren't hungry because they were full of apple juice.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they often had diarrhea from all the apple juice. But, you know, this, and then when the parent would stop the apple juice, then the child's appetite would kick in and they'd do a better job of eating from the meals. Many children do not do a good job of regulating their food intake when they graze. And by regulating, I mean eating the right amount of food to grow predictably and consistently.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids will overeat and get too fat. Other kids won't eat enough and sort of fall off their growth chart, and other kids grow just fine. It seems like there are some children who are so good at regulating, they'll just eat the right amount and grow consistently no matter what. But the deal is you don't know which child you have, and so, you know, you're really far better off to maintain structure of meals and snacks and not let children graze, because, you know, grazing sort of defeats their ability to regulate food intake and grow consistently. So that was, did grazing.
That's the grazing. How about short order cooking?
Short order cooking, ha. Well, short order cooking is when the child says, I don't like that, and the parent says, well, what do you want? And the parent gets up and makes it. Which is as strong a message as you possibly could give a child that you really don't expect them to learn to like this food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the child's job is to learn to eat the food the parents eat. That's what you had to do when you were little, and it's what I had to do, too.
Mm-hmm.
And children will do that. They push themselves along to accomplish this task, but it takes them time. And it takes a lot of, repeated neutral exposure. They have to see this food a lot of times, and they have to look at it, and they have to see their parents eat it, and eventually they put it on the plate, and eventually they put it in their mouth, and then they take it back out again, which to parents means that they don't like it, but actually it's the child's way of getting accustomed to the taste and texture so he can take this big step of swallowing it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a long time, and, you know, the studies say it takes 5 to 10 to 20 exposures, and experience tells us that for certain foods and certain kids, it takes even a lot longer than that. And so if the parent doesn't understand this, if the parent expects the child to eat something, you know, right off the bat and the first time he sees it, then the parent is going to get all desperate about it, maybe put on pressure, which is really going to make the child not eat it. Or if the parent feels a lot of investment of getting this food, a food, into the child, then they'll get up and make an alternative. And, and usually this all starts when the child is a toddler. And, what self-respecting toddler can really resist refusing food under that circumstance? I mean, here's this wonderful opportunity to jerk the parent around.
Right.
And they, these little ones, they'd rather do that than eat any day.
Mm-hmm. So, I always refer to the inmates don't run the asylum in my home.
Well, and that's absolutely true. And so, and parents like the division of responsibility, you know, that once they get that idea, then they say, oh, yeah, I see. But it's interesting how often parents will say, as I heard a parent say just the other day, well, you know, I have to get food into him, and if he doesn't eat something, I have to find something that he will eat.
Well, I'll tell you, as you're going through the book, you're looking at this division of responsibility, and in a lot of the examples you give as well, you can tell that parents get, like, freaked out by it.
Yeah.
And they're just totally just, wait a minute now, you know, and you really go into detail in the book about how not to be cute and clever with the foods, and we're going to get into that in just a moment, because that was really like, because I'm thinking, too, being very nutritionally oriented, I'm thinking, hey, no problem. We'll make sure that what's on the table isn't pure good, but it's going to be 80% good.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, it's more like, yeah, watch it.
Yeah, you might have to lighten up even from that.
You might have to back it off a little bit. Well, let me play devil's advocate just a bit here.
All right.
As a parent, which of course I am, everybody knows I've got 3 kids, and they're all still at home, it's my job to control how much my kid eats, right? I mean, I'm going to get that family meal, and I'm going to say, I'm going to make sure that they've got the 8-inch plate or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to do whatever
that's
cute and clever to make sure that as best I can, like you said, give the look or do whatever to control how much my kids eat.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the answer is really in the division of responsibility. But why is that just wrong?
Well, you know, if your kids haven't taught you otherwise, and we know, of course, that they have, and you knew better in the first place,
right,
that if they haven't taught you otherwise, either you have some super compliant children, or you're a hard-hearted man.
Mm-hmm. Right. Neither. Yeah.
And so, no, it doesn't work. In fact, you can never tell, you can't predict for another person how much they're going to want to eat. And then you add on top of that, the fact that children are just incredibly erratic about what they'll eat from one day to the next. That a food that they loved yesterday, they'll turn down flat today. They eat a lot one day, not so very much the next. You know, they're extremely erratic about their food intake. And so if a parent tries to break into that and impose certain amounts and types of food, it can really clash with this child's extremely sophisticated way of regulating food intake and, you know, partaking of the family food to have a nutritionally adequate diet. And so, you know, if you try to get a child to eat certain amounts and types of food, you're just going to have really big food battles, and it's going to spoil family meals for everybody.
Would you tell the story that's in the book as best you can anyway, just, you know, if you just have to go from memory, because this was one where I was like, man, this really drove it home as far as building this trust. And because I want to, we'll talk in a minute here about, you know, how fear in the child creates so much of the overeating issues, if there is an overeating issue. Would you tell a story of the person in the book when it came to like putting a certain amount of bread on the table? And I think the parent had come to you and said, you know, you want me to put how much bread on the table?
Yeah, that was Leanne's parents.
And you took a stack and you were like this high or whatever.
Right, yep. I held my hands about a foot apart and I said, well, this much.
And they weren't that much bread?
Yeah.
Make sure you listen for part two of this two-part series of my interview with Ellen Satter. We've already covered a great deal of incredibly valuable stuff, but there's a lot more to come, so make sure you don't miss it. Please make sure you are subscribed to the Club Lifestyle Podcast so you don't miss any of my podcasts in the future. More information about the Leanness Lifestyle, my products and services, and more can be found at www.leannesslifestyle.com. That's www.leannesslifestyle.com. Or simply look for Club Lifestyle in the iTunes podcast directory. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Next episode, I'll talk about how Club Lifestyle was really created, how it came into its own, and what I really do for members there. Until next time, remember, nothing tastes as good as living lean feels. And most of a great body transformation isn't hard, it just is.